Yes, sir, you are. You're listening to the John Carlin Sherry Ellicker Show, the 67th most popular talk show in America. Gaining ground every single day. Right, sir? How are we doing? Are we still 67th?
Still 67th.
All right. Holding steady right there. Haven't fallen at all, have we?
Sure haven't.
Oh, yeah. Teeny's ready to go. Teeny, Sherry, let Sherry in. Press the button, let her in. What do you think, huh?
The answer is no.
All right. Teeny winning the Employee of the Week. She has a lot of power around here. We can vote to overrule Teeny. Motion on the floor. Let's Sherry in. I vote yes. Joe?
Yes.
Teeny?
This is absolutely the worst day of my life.
Okay. And rise. Andrew? Andrew?
I'm yes as well. Let her in.
Sorry, Sherry. That was a little bit... I hope you didn't hear any of that. I don't know the words.
I seem so gross in this song.
Really, no.
These are the things you picked out, not anything else.
You wouldn't know you. Like, big hands, three nipples, likes cupcakes.
Hates kids, dogs. Loves dogs. Dogs.
I mean, and she is, everybody.
I'm a monster. It's Sherry.
It's Sherry the monster. Not even know. Oh, yeah. All right. By the way, 3:30. An inspirational story from my friend Steph, who lives here in Clee Ellum. I said to Joe about a half hour, an hour ago, I said, hey, get her on the phone, talk to her, a little pre-show kind of interview, find out how she was able to beat meth. And man, Joe, what a story, right? Holy Lord.
Yeah,
oh,
long
my
one.
God. What a journey she's had. So, because this is a big topic all the time. We talk about this. Homeless and drugs and stuff. We give you the problems. We don't give you the solutions. So it's always nice to find somebody who found some way out of this. So that's at 3:30. But in the meantime, remember that tragic story that happened up at the gorge? Guy takes some mushrooms. I don't know if it was the mushrooms necessarily that caused it, but he has hallucinations and stuff. Gets into a fight with his girlfriend, ends up shooting two people, killing two. And now, as one might expect, here come the
families
lawyers.
Of Brandy Escamilla and Jocelyn Ruiz, who were shot and killed last summer at a music festival at the Gorge Amphitheater, are now suing the event organizer. The lawsuit claims Live Nation failed to enforce safety policies to ensure firearms and illegal drugs were not present at the festival. Tonight, we spoke with the attorney representing the victims' families. He says Live Nation failed.
They continue to put profits over safety, and they put their festival goers in harm's way. They completely failed to have adequate security screening. They failed to have canine weapon sniffing dogs at the check-in. They had an overall failure in security at not only the concert venue, but also the campground. And all of these failures directly led to this situation where a man was allowed to bring in weapons and ammunition and get extremely intoxicated on hallucinogenic drugs. And he lost his mind and started firing his weapon. And Live Nation could have and should have prevented all of this.
James Kelly is accused of shooting and killing the two Seattle nurses. Kelly was an active duty soldier at Joint Base Lewis-McChord at the time. Prosecutors say he had taken hallucinogenic mushrooms before the festival. And once the drugs kicked in, he started thinking the world was ending. Kelly was shot and injured by Moses Lake police officers and taken into custody. He's now charged with two counts of murder and is set to go on trial in August.
Okay, so this always happens, right? Something, you're not going to be able to sue the guy that shot and killed because he doesn't have any money, so you go for the biggest fish. Then you have to be able to prove liability. You also have to prove that they know that they had a problem and they didn't do anything about the problem. So my brother always described it, first year of law school for him at Villanova. Graduate top of his class, by the way. He said it's called the ice machine liability. The guy, you own a restaurant, and one of the waiters goes, Mark, the ice machine's leaking. Oh, okay. Now you know. They told him, hey, by the way, you could do something about it. You need a note on there. Look out, ice machine's leaking. So now you know you have the liability. Got the ice machine. You know it's leaking. Somebody told you it's leaking. A bunch of employees told you, hey, watch out, the ice machine's leaking. The owner of the restaurant now knows the ice machine is leaking and doesn't do anything about it. A waiter comes around the corner, picks up a big heavy tray, slips into the water, falls back, hits his head, dies. Liability is clearly on the restaurant owner, who knew that he had a problem with the ice machine, didn't fix it. The water pooled under the ice machine. The waiter hits his head, dies, right? So clear. So then you have the point. Does Live Nation and the people that organize the security, do they have everything possible with any reasonable person, say, within, you know, everything within their power? Do they provide the most amount of security they could possibly promote without causing additional harm to either creeping long lines and people passing out and the cars backing up? Is it a traffic issue? Can you mitigate that sort of stuff? So they've got to find that they knew they had the problem, didn't do anything about it. That would be a slam dunk for them. Or what they'll probably do is settle this thing out of court, because Live Nation's like, you know, there's no way we can possibly police all of this. We try to do the best we can. Having gone to a bunch of concerts to the Gorge, and Joe, have you been there as well?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the drinking is crazy. They try to control it as much as they can, but it's crazy. That's why people go out there to the Gorge.
Yeah, this story, the guy took the mushrooms, and then didn't he go back to his truck and get the gun and then started, when he went into that state of paranoia, and then he came out and got into an argument with his girlfriend or something like that. But if it's an open air concert, how are they going to screen for stuff in cars?
So this is primarily related to the campground, and that's where this occurred.
The campground.
So yeah, you can drive your car to the campground. The question is, you're never going to keep drugs out. You're never going to keep alcohol out. So the question is,
no.
What's their policy on bringing guns to the campground? And I'm assuming they have a no guns policy. I know they do check, especially right after this. A friend of mine went there and they had to sit in line for upwards of 3 hours to get in because they had drugs coming or dogs coming out of their camper and essentially looking for guns. So that's the issue here. Where did he have his gun? Was it hidden? You know?
Yeah. And, you know, and then it's, did they do everything they can? Somebody would try to sneak something in, they can. You know, do you have the signs and do you enforce it? There's that sort of thing. But again, it's one of these things that if someone legally has the right, can they carry? But now they're moving on to private property and you can stop somebody from carrying the gun onto private property. There's probably some gray area in there. But the guy had it in his car. So you said it's 3 hour backup. And to get into the Gorge anyway and to sit there in that heat and wait 3 hours to get in. And then were they checking during the concerts and stuff when people were in the campground? Were they walking around?
Doubt it. They may do that now, but I've camped out there several times. I've never seen anyone, security or otherwise, coming through the campground and checking. They do the checks on the way in, and then, you know, they assume that if you had anything or you hit it well enough to where they couldn't find it.
Yeah, I get it. Good news for you, Sherry, because the three French bulldogs stolen from a van in Kirkland. What were they doing in the van? Were they driving the van? Because I know those dogs are smart.
No. They had pulled into a gas station. Well, they didn't.
The dogs did, or the driver did?
The driver did. He went in, I guess, to get something. And when he came back, it was gone.
Wait, don't ruin it. Don't ruin it. Fox 13's got more.
I hope they have a conscience. I really do. Because I don't think they knew that they were stealing from us or that the dogs were in there.
You can hear the heartbreak in dog breeder Elsie Whitney's voice. We talked to her on Sunday after she said someone stole her van with her three French bulldogs inside while her husband was at a gas station in Kirkland. In this surveillance video, you can see the suspect getting behind the wheel of that van.
On Monday, a Fox 13 viewer sent us these photos of the abandoned van after it was found in a Bellevue apartment complex. Unfortunately, the...
Uh-oh. Sherry, to have a happy ending?
It does. Otherwise,
three hold on.
We're not inside. Whitney was really worried about the three bulldogs because they needed medication for recent surgery. Well, tonight, we have an excellent update from Kirkland Police. The three French bulldogs have been found.
He hit it on us. You see, he's sort of going sad, mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, bah, right?
Whew, right.
Head snapping moment. 180 degree turn. Wow.
They're healthy and they were reunited with their family.
Fox 13 was there as Whitney's husband saw them for the very first time tonight.
So how the hell did you find them? Good police work.
They're going all in on this one, aren't they?
I know. I know. And the guy wasn't, like, overjoyed. I mean, he was like, heck, how'd you hell find him?
Oh, yeah. Wow, you dad. Hi, guys. Hey, John Paul, how are you?
They're in great shape. They look good. Yeah, I'm gonna take them over to the vet.
Oh, that is just so wonderful to see. Kirkland police say with the help of King County Sheriff's deputies, the dogs were located in White Center tonight. All the dogs appear to be in great health. We asked Whitney's husband how his wife is reacting to the news.
But when I called, she was just speechless. But these guys did a hell of a job.
The mayor of Kirkland and the police department are planning a parade for the dogs this weekend.
Good, good. They deserve it, those poor little things. Imagine
They'll also be given a key to the city, and the local library will be named, renamed after all three of the French Bulldogs.
Well, you know, French Bulldogs are very, very expensive. I mean, we met a guy who paid, I think it was an insane amount, like $13,000 to get a color that he wanted. So they're very expensive, and I'm sure they were going to be, I don't think they were going to be disposed of. They probably were going to be sold unless they just wanted to take the van. And they didn't realize the dogs were in it.
I think they're there for the van, Sherry.
Oh, okay. Well, at least they didn't hurt the dogs, poor things.
That's right. Well, they're fine, Sherry. And you can be, just announced Sherry will be the grand marshal of the parade.
Oh, thank you.
There you go.
Good.
All right.
I love that.
Along with teeny tiny lady in a pickle jar.
Oh, I'm busy that day. I forgot. When is it?
Seattle Public Libraries are resorting to the rolling branch closures. They don't have enough money. They say that because the pandemic and that caused them a bunch of problems and now they don't have enough money. The money comes in from primarily from real estate taxes. And they said, yeah, just its cost is too high. The people that work there are government employees. Hard to fire them. So rather than trying to get more money for the library, they've decided, because remember, they put a hiring freeze in place. They're in Seattle's in big trouble when it comes to revenue. They said, well, we're going to do, you know, we'll just close earlier, open later, close this day, close that day, you know, trying to mitigate the fact that they don't have enough money to pay people. I looked it up. I could save them $5.5 million right now, Sherry.
Oh, well, do tell.
Well, the King County Library has started, I think it's 12 people that are on the DEI. They're part of DEI, and they're paying their new DEI person, I think, like, it might be $200,000 if you eliminate the entire DEI King County Library division, although all those fine people doing all that work that they can't actually prove that they're doing any work, you save about $5 million. But why you need DEI people at a library, I'm not quite sure, but that's part of it, so they could whack all those people and save about $5 million. The other news is the fact that our libraries even that important anymore. I looked at the decline in libraries, the number of people that go to the library, the number of people that use the library. I had said the other day on Jack and Spike, it's a gigantic building. If you're really concerned about all this climate stuff, why don't you close it down because it costs you a lot to heat it and everything else and allow people to use everything digitally. The fact that the King County or the Seattle Library says, well, we also have to provide social services to people because we have people that come in there. They need help with drug addiction and alcohol. We can redirect them to different places. They have Narcan for the staff there. I mean, what's the library doing now that it's sort of moving into more of the social service program? And they had to train everybody. They've got security for everyone. I'd read one piece of review. I didn't check it out necessarily, but the person says they noticed there's normally a line of people waiting out in front for the library to open. They're there because they need some shelter. Perfectly understand that. If you're homeless, it's probably a nice place to hang out. But they're looking to cut back on the library. Most people don't go to the library or use the library. And the number of people that are actually going through the door every single year at libraries continues to decrease. But it's this thing, like, you got to feel like you have to have one. It feels nice to have a library.
Well, yeah, I mean, libraries are great, and they serve a great purpose if that's what they're doing. But they did a survey. 32% of people never visit the library. And the Washington Post did this really extensive article about these great libraries all over the world and how unbelievable they are. And they've got this and that and this and that. But the reality is that they're not really functioning as a central part of the town anymore. Library isn't like that. People don't say, oh, I'll meet you at the library. So are they really necessary? Should they be closing some of them down? With some of the libraries in Washington, they have let go of all late fees. So
yeah, I know that. Right.
Why even bother to take it back? You know, I mean, people can just walk off with the books.
Sherry, come on.
Sherry, please.
What?
Please.
Okay.
Just return your library book because it's the right thing to do.
So you took out a book on French bulldogs and you want to learn about, you know, you're going to bring it back. 7% of Americans visit libraries weekly. 22% report visiting libraries at least once or twice a month. Hardly a large number. Almost 6 in 10 Americans report they seldom or never visit a public library. 32% plurality. It's also most people using it digitally. It's great because you can get the library card, download books, have that. You don't even have to go to the library. If you really wanted to save the world, close it down. That way people want to drive cars and they could do it all digitally. We'll see how many people are up in arms about the Seattle Library. The King County Library Association closing some of their doors down. What are you laughing at, you two?
Last time, funny in the back there? Yeah.
Yes.
Last time I visited the library, it was to get my passport. Another sort of offshoot of what libraries are becoming. I got my my passport and my COVID vaccine.
At the library?
No, I'm kidding. I did get my passport there, or did whatever I had to do.
Now that's funny. So I go to the library the other day. I got a passport. Too early on the. I didn't get the punchline yet, Andrew. Hold on. So I go to the library, right? I'm in the library, right? I get a passport. Here we are with the John Curley, Sherry Elliger Show. Don't forget the know-it-all quiz coming up. Teeny Tiny's got all the cookies out. A whole bunch of cookies coming your way. That's right. All you do is answer one simple question correctly of the five that I'm in the midst of writing. We'll do that at 5:30. You can write to us at mynorthwest.com. Although Andrew says don't bother. Text Joe. 1-888-973-5476.
Your mama.
One interesting about yourself, and next thing you know, you're launching into the world of radio. Sherry, ever meet anybody just instantaneously? You're like, I like that person.
Sure.
You meet someone like that?
You.
There's a brightness, a joy that's behind the person's eyes. It's in their smile, which just turns on. 1,000-watt light bulb, and it helps that the person has an incredibly loud voice and absolutely no filter whatsoever, which is my friend Steph, who I met a number of years ago in Cleveland when I first moved there. And I happen to be over, is it the dollar store? I call it the dollar store. What's it called officially?
Yeah, it's the Dollar Tree.
Dollar Tree. Mm-hmm. So I'm in there buying some great stuff.
Julie.
And I made some comment, and Steph, who's now the manager there, goes, oh, well, yeah, I was addicted to meth for a long time, but I'm sober. It's so loud. The whole store hears it. And these people that are in line with me start applauding her. She goes, yep. I beat it. Steph, the reason you're on, not only because I'm looking for a discount there at the Dollar Tree, but also we talk all the time about homelessness and meth and the police and blah, the homeless. So I love stories of success so that people are not constantly bombarded by all the negative. So walk us through your life, and I'll start. So you were 12 years old and you were living with, was it your mom and dad, or where were you living when you were 12?
Yeah, I was living with my mom and my stepdad, and they were both really busy people, and this town gets really boring. So I had been hanging out with some unsavory people while they were busy working and got access, and that was when I took my first hit, and I didn't get like actually addicted to it until I was a little bit, for like a year or so, but I was casually doing it at 12 years old. Yeah.
Meth. And what you were doing was meth.
Yeah, it was meth. I smoked meth before I ever even smoked pot.
So the rule of on the street of meth is that once you get that first hit, you're always chasing that high, because that first high is always the best high, and then every high after that is never as good. So that's why people then keep doing it and doing it. So then your story continues in that you end up then moving to Olympia to live with your father's side of the family. And most of those people also not a very good influence in your life?
Actually, just about everybody on my father's side of the family are meth addicts, yes. Yes, actually, my father was recently involved with one of the biggest drug busts in Lewis County. So, yeah.
So there's no help for you there. And then you end up having a little girl when you're 17 years old, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that doesn't stop you. This is, I hear the sadness already in your voice. It doesn't stop you. You're still smoking it even while you're pregnant.
Yeah, I was using during my pregnancy, and I was definitely warned by my doctors about it. And she was born with some learning disabilities. I was lucky that she wasn't born worse off, because I didn't stop anything during the pregnancy, but I don't even know what I was thinking at that time. You know, I was a baby having a baby, and I was on my own. So, yeah.
Steph, the people always say, but a mother's love will supersede everything. But I guess the drug has a sort of a different MO, doesn't it? Even though, you know, you're
100%. I do not feel like a child will stop you from something that is that intrusive in your life. I mean, because meth will destroy you. You know, it's pretty bad. It didn't stop me until, you know, my daughter was taken away from me. The state didn't get involved, but my mother actually got involved. My mom's a really good, she's a good woman. She's never been into drugs real bad or nothing. So she took care of my daughter for a year while I went and got my stuff together. I decided to hitchhike.
tell me about that. You hitchhiked from where to where?
I hitchhiked from Olympia, and I ended up in Kansas, Junction City, Kansas.
How come Kansas? Is that just kind of like you gave up at that point where you just figured I'm tired of hitchhiking, or was there someone there that you were going to?
My best friend was living there at the time, so I ended up going there, and that wasn't the best situation for me either. So I hitchhiked back, and I was like, I'm not doing this ever again, the drug thing. And but then I came back and I got into other stuff. I have not touched methamphetamine since. But I do feel like it was an initiative to get my daughter back, you know, to stop doing it. But I felt like, oh, I'm not doing meth. I'm doing everything else, but I'm not doing meth. So, you know, I got my daughter back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was that, did that prove to be beneficial to your daughter, to have your daughter back with you? Did it help you? And is it a safe place for your daughter, if you answer honestly?
Honestly, probably not. No. I definitely changed as a mom. I actually wanted to be a mom. I wanted to be better. But it still didn't stop me from the alcohol, the marijuana, and all the other drugs that came, you know, like cocaine or Molly was a big one for me. I got really into that one for a long time. And yeah. So Steph, no, I don't. What's that?
You had three more children.
after your first child. And were you also using during those pregnancies? And how did you manage to keep it all together? I mean, you have this disease of addiction, and then you've got to be a full-time mom to four kids. How did that all shake out?
Well, I did manage to stay clean and sober during the pregnancies of my children, but it was like right when they would come out, I would go right back to the partying stuff. And I was also in a pretty healthy relationship at the time, even though he was using.
Wow. So
yeah, but we managed to be decent parents, but were we really? You know, I mean, looking at it now, it's so different, you know, because back then I thought I'm being a good mom. I'm here. I'm present.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really mentally present.
So we always hear that people won't make that big change to change their life and begin to get help until they hit rock bottom. So in the remaining time, what was rock bottom and where are you now?
So to me, I've hit rock bottom so many times from what, you know, like just life experiences and all this stuff. Like rock bottom can be so many different things. And I felt like I've hit it so many times, and then I pop right back up like a jack in the box. But then I go right back to what I was doing.
Right.
So this about 5 months ago, I was out, I was drinking, I was high on cocaine, popping some mushrooms, and I had maybe three beers. I could keep my cool. I was a drinker. I'm an alcoholic, and I can keep my cool. I had three beers, and a man brought me a shot, and I don't remember anything after that shot.
Steph, I want to hear the rest of your story. You can hear the music's coming in. That's good. Nate's got traffic. Would you do us a favor? I assume you're managing right now. Is it okay if we hold you over for a little longer? I just want to hear where you are now and how you're able to get that help. Will you do that? Can you stay with us?
Yes, sir. Of course.
All right. Hang on. Talking to my friend Steph. She's the manager over at Dollar Tree. When I was waiting in line the other day, and I said, "Man, you are one of the happiest people I know." And she's like, "Oh, yeah. Oh, my, yeah, I've been 5 months clean and sober, go to Narcotics Anonymous." It yells it out over the whole store. I thought, this woman has no trouble telling her story. And I thought, Steph, I'd have you on because there are people, parents, there's people that suffer, that either have loved ones or they themselves in this situation. It's something we always deal with all the time on radio, the homeless and the drugs, and the homeless and drugs, what could do. Let's arrest them. Let's get them to clean up, get them move out. You know, they always talk about rock bottom. You told us earlier, and you could listen, folks that missed it, Steph's story about, and she hit rock bottom like three times, describing yourself as a jack-in-the-box bouncing back up again. So you've dealt with this. You started smoking meth at 12. Your life story reads, unfortunately, as your own story, but one that's probably been repeated millions of times for people that really have, as Sherry said, a disease. Obviously, your father is an addict. He probably passed those genes on to you. So you end up being at a bar. Somebody slips you a roofie or something. You completely black out. You have no idea where you are for 5 hours. You realize this is incredibly dangerous. So for you, that was the turning point. That was when you said, "Steph, I got to do something with my life."
Yeah.
That was it.
Yes.
That turned you around, huh?
Yeah, I realized that I had to do it for myself. I can't rely on doing it for other people, not for the court system, not for nobody. I had to do it for me. And I lost control, obviously.
Yeah. And Steph, there's a lot of debate about consequences, and there's a lot of debate about what really helps people get into recovery. Where do you stand on that? Do you think there needs to be consequences, whether it be arrests or jail time or whatever, or do you think that people need to come to that conclusion by themselves, and that's the only way they're really going to be successful?
With the experience that I've had and with my family, I feel like that it's 100% is it has to be in yourself. For years, I've been in the court system. I've done jail time. I've I've had to do a lot. I've had to jump through a lot of hoops, and none of that kept me clean. None of it kept me sober. And now, today, I want it. And I go to meetings on my own. I'm staying clean and sober on my own. I don't have the court system holding me to this, to do this. I'm doing this for me this time, and it's actually working. And I would like to say, you know, throw all the drug addicts in jail or put them in rehab. But I've done all that, and it didn't keep me clean. It didn't keep my family clean. It didn't keep, you know, it doesn't always help. I mean, it can if the person really wants it.
Yeah. If the government hands out free needles to people, does that feel like, well, I guess the government's okay with me doing this?
I believe that some people might feel that way. My personal opinion on that is, I mean, we're helping prevent disease, if nothing else, by handing out clean needles.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff Semper Fi, a buddy of mine, did same, different story, but same outcome for you. He said she's one of the 3%. I don't know where he got the number. I'm assuming he knows what he's talking about, but the most people just can't kick it, right? And for you, it had to be you that made the decision, not some external force. It has to come from the inside. So what is Narcotics Anonymous like for the fifth month? You go three times a week?
Yes, and actually I've been involved for about 7 years. Even though I was still using and everything, I still had that to turn to. And I absolutely love the people in Narcotics Anonymous. It's almost a friend group. And you have other people who have been through exactly what you've been through or similar to what you've been through to have your back. Like, they know what you've been through. It's almost like therapy without the therapist. You've just got a bunch of other addicts to talk to, you know. But it's great. I love it. I do it 2-3 times a week. I go to a meeting for at least an hour. And it's mostly support. And you hear other people's stories, and it's inspiring.
Yeah.
Do you have, any advice for anybody out there that's thinking they want to get to that point, but they just can't do it? Do you have, you can't force someone to hit bottom, but what would you say to somebody that's thinking about it?
I would definitely say to search your soul and reach out to people who are sober and clean. Reach out to the ones that you know have that time under their belt, and definitely connect with people who have been through it, because if you can do it before you hit rock bottom, even better.
Well, we're hoping, and I'm pretty sure that your words have helped somebody out there. So I'll see you at the Dollar Tree soon, okay? I need some more paper towels and liquid soap.
Safeway in line.
Thanks, sweetie. Have a great weekend.
All right. Talk to you soon, John. Right.
Bye, Steph. How about that, huh, Sherry?
Yeah. Huh?
Good stuff. That's all right.
Very, very tough.
Huh?
It's very, very tough, you know?
But it's good to get stories of hope. It helps.
Oh, yeah.